This is tape number 0518. It was recorded on Thursday, May 13th, 2004, as a part of the Beeson Institute for Advanced Church Leadership, Module 5, at the Church of the Resurrection in Kansas City, Kansas. This message is presented by Carl George, entitled Training Staff, How to Train Lay Leaders. This recording was produced through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. Please do not transcribe into manuscript form or generate other copies without expressed written permission from Asbury Theological Seminary.
Who walks among the people in your mission field constantly, and who, because they have been deputized as a caregiving person, are seen and function as an extension of you and of your church staff. And one of the things that is an invaluable skill set to learn is for you and for your staff to all learn how to empower laypersons to act on your behalf and on the behalf of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. If we could do that, we can get the job done, whatever the budget is, because the Holy Spirit is pledged to give gifted people to us to meet the needs of the body of Christ. So the challenge that we're going to face is, how can we train our lay leaders in such a way that they serve as functionally adequate extensions of that to which God has called us? And no matter what size church you are, you're going to have a need for this. And this is a huge multiplier factor, and that's what I want to turn our attention to this morning. I believe that the secret to this has to do with a social psychology concept called roles. Now, we use different terms to talk about roles. Sometimes we refer to them as hats that people wear. And that comes after the custom we have of costuming people according to their particular specialties. When you see an officer step out of his car and he puts on his hat and he walks up towards you, as I did just recently, he is putting on himself one of the indications of office. It's the color of his authority. It's this navy blue or black hat that has this distinctive profile that says, don't mess with me. There's more where I come from, and you do not want to get involved in this chase. And he cloaks himself in a role, and it doesn't matter whether he's the nicest person in the world. When he gets up there, he's going to shine the light in your eye. He's going to check to see where your hands are to make sure that there's nothing dangerous coming at him from them. And he's going to say, may I see your driver's license, please? That's if he's exceptionally polite and it's early in the shift. So you're going to dig out the driver's license. You're going to hand it to him without very much argument. And his role is at work. You have learned that no matter who he is, that there are certain things you can expect from him or her. And the things that you're going to learn it will cause you to behave in a predictable way in that setting. And that person will be behaving in a predictable way in that setting. And those behaviors are more constrained by role than you know. That is your concept of what the role is. In our town, somebody ran over a control meter box for traffic lights and blew out about 3 blocks worth of traffic lights. And it just so happens that they're the heaviest intersections in our little village. And it is a mess because we're just off the freeway and things back up by the mile if you don't keep those intersections clear. And if there is a trained traffic officer in the vicinity, they can get the flow through those traffic lights, even though not functional, up to speed very, very quickly. But they are people not to be messed with. They stand there in the middle of that. They've got their gloves on so you can see their hands. They've got their red vests on so that you don't hit them. They stand right in the middle in a life-imperiling place. And you come and go, and you ask them, you know, may I turn here? No, they say, by just a flick of the wrist and elbow, and you do what they say. The other day, I was way down the street from where I wanted to be because the guy wouldn't let me go where I wanted to go. But he had bigger fish to fry. He had semis to get out of the traffic, and he had the traffic to unclog. And we didn't argue with him because he was a man who knew how to take his ground, take his place, and he did so with a great deal of confidence. I have watched rookies do that same job, and they stutter. They stand out there, and they don't know whether to blow the whistle or gesture. They don't know how to frown appropriately with the proper amount of intimidation. They let people get away with things. The traffic stops and stops, and people get insecure, and it's a mess. But once a person becomes fully invested in the role, so that they know what they can expect from people and know what level of assertion is necessary to communicate clearly what they're trying to do, things speed up and traffic flows. Now, how do we get people to that place so that they're able to function with that degree of suave, you know, suave or whatever? It's interesting to me to watch in newbies and in people who haven't done these kind of things before how hesitating and how timid they are, and how a little bit of affirmation after an actual exposure to behavior settings can increase their level of confidence and increase their ability to perform enormously. I'll never forget a timid lady, master's degree person, competent in her work, did her first hospital call on her own, came and stood there and said, I went to the bedside of so-and-so, yes, and I spoke with her as sympathetically as I knew how, yes, and I just felt like I didn't have the words that were adequate for whatever was needed. So I opened a Bible and I read a psalm, and I said, yes. Well, what psalm did you read? She says, the 23rd psalm. Oh, that's a good choice. That's a good choice. There are some imprecatory psalms I don't think are bedside appropriate. But she got to an appropriate psalm, and I said, that's excellent. And how did the presentation? Well, she seemed calmed by it, I see. And she, I even prayed. Oh, I said, and what did you pray? She said, I just prayed a simple prayer that Jesus would comfort her, and nothing happened. I said, well, what did you expect? She said, well, I don't know, but was it okay? I mean, I'm not a clergy or anything. And I thought, no, I think you did exactly the right thing. I mean, you gave her comfort from the scripture. You offered a prayer for her. You stood there with her. You didn't sit on the bed or shake her or anything. And the medical staff didn't run you out of the room. You did the same thing I would have done if I'd been standing there. Oh, really? And she got 3 inches taller. And I thought, this person's competent in her job and in her line of work. She handles herself well. But then I realized she was in an unfamiliar setting. She was in a different place than she had been. She didn't know who would come out and blow the whistle and say, this is not appropriate for you to be doing this or to be here. I said, what you did was exactly appropriate. And as a matter of fact, had you been challenged by the medical staff, it would have been perfectly okay for you to say, Pastor has asked me to make this call. I said, because this is a part of what you will be doing as a small group person in our congregation. Okay, thank you. And she went away. Well, I don't know how many hundreds of hospital calls have been made since that time because one person was affirmed to assume a role that is normally, in her eyes, reserved for a clergy person. I ordained her to hospital bedside visitation in the simple act of an affirmation. Now, we have more opportunities to do this than we know. But there is an almost a magic involved with understanding how roles work. Now, attitudes can be managed in a population. Attitudes can be managed by inspiration. You can tell stories and cry and sing and laugh and tease and so forth. And you can get people to change their minds about stuff. You can change an attitude by speech, by inspirational speech. But what we've learned is that behaviors are managed by roles. When people see themselves as operating in a particular office or role, then they behave in a way that is consistent with that role with greater assurance and greater consistency than if you just suggest an idea. And that's why it's so critically important that we understand that roles influence behaviors. They influence behaviors because they bring to our mind's eye a whole set of patterns of what appropriate behaviors for that role are. And that allows the person who is in that role to assume the position, whether it's in the middle of traffic or whether it's at the bedside of a parishioner in the hospital. Now, that means then that role reinterpretation can be a strategy for behavior change. If you can take a person who is occupying a role and you can in some way help them to get a picture or image of how that role should be behaving, then you can influence their behavior in all settings where that role is evoked. You can have a profound influence on behavior. Now, let me give you an example. Someone comes to your church and they expect to find a parking spot. They expect to be directed. They expect to have a door open for them. They expect to have you hand them the bolt, and they expect to be greeted warmly. They expect to have their children directed to the appropriate part of the building. They expect to be ushered into a seat. They're just full of expectations that you will wait on them because the role that they are occupying is that of consumer. The place has been set up for my convenience, they say as they walk in. And you say to yourself, that's okay, because we want them to feel welcome here. But we don't want them forever to feel welcome here in that same role, because otherwise, if they have this imperious, you're here to wait on me attitude, pretty soon they're very difficult to manage. You want a shift in their role. You want to reinterpret them as a person who comes on site, and you want them to gain such a sense of ownership that they begin to behave more like a host. You want the expectations that they have to be that I am here to help pick up trash if necessary. I'm here to help open a door and hold it. I'm here to run an umbrella out to somebody if need be. I'm here to serve in some fashion. I'm here to expedite other people's finding information that they need. When a question is asked of me, I say, I don't know, I just go here. We want them to say, I don't know, but I'm sure going to help you find out what we can learn. Let's go over to the information center and let's dig out the stuff. It's an amazing difference when a person moves from consumer to host. And what does a host do? And by telling a story, by picturing how things do, you can refurbish people's mental image of what's involved in a given role. And in doing so, you'll see profound changes in their behavior. The other day I was walking into a place. I noticed a fellow reach down, pick up a piece of paper. Continued to follow him, so I walked into the office and said, President. He picked up a piece of paper, a piece of trash paper, a gum wrapper, on his way into the building. And he was the top guy in the organization. It was the only gum wrapper I saw on my visit there. I know why. He had modeled so beautifully his care for the environment that his people had seen that behavior, no doubt. And that behavior became standard for a person who had a sense of ownership in that place. It's small things that we sometimes do and say, or it's the stories that we repeat with approval, that give people a new image of what needs to be a part of what that role that they're occupying is. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to take people from customers of Jesus Christ to agents of Jesus Christ, to citizens of the kingdom in the sense of being protected and under the protections of the kingdom, to being workers within the kingdom so that they're able to carry the torch, the flag, and be an operative within that environment. Now, if you're going to help your people, you're going to have to make some things explicit so that they are not confused by those things. And that has to do with the expectations that you set for them. I have been learning that we can set expectations for our lay leaders and for our staff that bring them into a partnership with one another so that our staff see the lay leaders as partner and our lay leaders see staff as partner, and they see themselves both as partners with you as the senior leaders and partners with Jesus in his kingdom of reaching and helping people. But to do that, you can't be confused about what you're looking for and what you're expecting. You're going to have to be explicit in explaining to people what the expectations are for them and what they can reasonably expect from you. Because in order to operate within a role, they have to know what the limits are on their privileges, and they have to know what they can reasonably count on you for. I'll never forget how I got caught in this experientially one day. when I received a letter in the mail from my pastor, and he said, you have been named as one of our small group leaders by the people who attend your group, and I would like to meet with you and other small group leaders next Saturday. And I went to the meeting, and the pastor said, he said, realistically, there are so many people in our congregation that I cannot hope to know their names in whatever number of years I'm going to be here. It's just not realistic. Furthermore, it will be some struggle for me to even know all of your names, because there's so many more of you than there are of me. I do want to care for you. I do want to support you. But I need for you to know you're the first line of defense and care for these people. You are their pastor. I'm the titular pastor. I'm the visible person. I'm the primary pulpit speaker. But when it comes right down to helping people at the point of their pain, I won't even know that they're in pain. You know them. You know their names. You know their pain. You are close to them. They have named you as their care group leaders. I need for you to know I'm counting on you. They're counting on you. And so here's the deal. If you hear of a crisis or a need in anyone within your care, I want you to know what my expectations are. Minister to them. Care for them. That may be all they need, and that may be all they get. But whatever you do, do not ask me or our staff to do the first contact work. We can't handle it. We'll advise you, we'll back you up, and if you have something that is really out of scope and is a tragedy of some sort, by all means call us for backup, and we'll provide every bit of backup we can within the limits of our schedule and availability. But we want to know that most of the things that are going to happen to the lives of the people in this church, they're going to happen in your knowledge, and the care of those people is going to be within your range of service. And you need to know you have our blessing as you do it. Now, to support you, I'll provide teaching outlines for you. To support you, we have a number of workshops in how to cope with various problems. We hope you'll take advantage of those. But whatever you do, go first, and then tell us what you did. And I went home and I said to Grace, I said, we had a nice meeting today. Pastor's well-spoken and he has a clear idea of what he expects. She said, what do you expect? He said, well, he expects us to minister to the people in our group, which we're willing to do anyway. But he just made it very clear. I didn't tell her the whole story because I didn't know what the significant parts of the story were. I didn't know how he had reinterpreted the role of small group leader to include pastoral care at a pastoral level. As a matter of fact, I didn't know what he had actually done until I was under fire several months later, and a member of our group called desperately for prayer for a sick infant. And I thought, boy, that's one I don't want to have to handle. Thank God I'm just a layman. And I started to say, well, by all means, let's call the church and get the staff member over there to hospital to pray for your baby. And I choked as I tried to get the words out, because what that pastor did in that little role refurbishing session he held that previous Saturday was he had fixed it so it wasn't legitimate to call directly for help in a raw pastoral care need. In order to call, I had to have already gone, because the thing that he was entitled to do now was he was entitled to say, when I called, what have you done to care for this family before you called us? Because that was the deal that was set. And I froze. I couldn't say to her, let's call the church staff. And then I thought, well, let's see, I'll get off the hook some other way. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not hero enough to have always accepted every challenge in the ministry as the stuff of life. I don't know about you, but I've been a wimp at points. There are certain times in the past, in my ministry, I've bugged out. I've gotten scared. I didn't want to expose myself to criticism or to risk. Ever been there? And this is one of them. It's not my finest moment. But it wasn't arrogant either. So that's the redeeming part of being a wimp, is it's not usually arrogant. So I tried to figure out what I was going to say to this lady, and I couldn't figure out how to get off the hook. So I said, well, okay, I'll call my wife and we'll make a visit. I called my wife and I said, honey, we got to go to the hospital and pray for this baby. And you know what she said? She said, you haven't passed yourself off as a healer, have you? And I said, believe me, no. I said, I tried every way I could to figure out how not to make this call. But remember that meeting I told you the pastor had us come into? He said we shouldn't be calling the office for backup help like this until we had first gone and done what we could do. Oh, she said, if the pastor said it, by all means, let's go. I'll be dressed. Come get me. I thought, what is this? I can't get her to do it, and just because the senior pastor said it, she's ready to go? That was a day of humiliation. We get down to the hospital and pray for the baby, and God heals her. And when it's all over, we look at that and we say, whoa, we saw a miracle. We saw a miracle because we were obedient. We saw a miracle because we had a pastor that set an expectation that we would go and pray. Everybody else that went in, they got to pray second. We got to be there in the front line. We got so excited. Wow, we hope somebody else will call. You know? We didn't hope someone else would get sick, but we hoped someone else would call, because we now knew the power of operating in the empowerment of a role where the terms have been set and where you know it's an okay thing to do. Quite contrary, I was in a congregation where a guy behind me tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, how could a fellow get some prayer around here? And I turned around and looked at him, and he had these purple marks all over him indicating he was under radio treatment, you know, under x-ray treatment for a serious throat cancer. And he'd just come from the hospital to the church looking for prayer. And something inside said, don't mess with this guy. Not because of him and his need, but because the church staff here are going to be very jealous of that opportunity. And you are not deputized to do this. So I thought to myself, I better go find a church staff member. So I said, wait right here and I'll go find somebody for you. And I was visiting. My first visit in it. So I went over and I found a staff member. The staff member looked at me and he said, you're not a member here. I said, I know. He says, you're not supposed to be praying for that guy. And I said, hey, I'm not praying for that guy. I'm trying to find somebody to hook him up with. I'll take care of it, he says. He blusterily strode past me and went over and talked to the guy. I thought, I'm glad I understood the terms here. These people have a well-defined set of expectations about what you won't do and what you will do. Now, to the credit of that staff member, he was fired 6 weeks later, but anyway, it's sometimes things are as they appear, and he was way out of line because he didn't have to be the blusterer to defend his role that he ought to roll. But what is it that you can do to set expectations with clarity with your people that will bring them into partnership? What is it that you can do? Now, you see before you in the notes, you see a little acrostic. It's a tic-tac-toe board, actually. A lot of churches have adopted that little acrostic or the words in it or the concepts behind it as a way of creating a covenant between themselves and their lay ministers, all those who have teams and groups within their church, and they expect them to take care of those people. A lot of them have added a 10th one, which is be a member of our fellowship, but because I didn't put membership as an issue in this particular set of roles. But a lot of churches will let a person serve for a term, but before they renew their franchise to serve another term as a small group leader, they'll ask them, they need to be a regular member of the church, profession of faith, baptism, or whatever your particular fellowship calls for that. So I always applaud when I see creative adaptations. But in these little nine squares, what I have learned to do is that in less than an hour's time, sometimes in less than 15 minutes' time, I can help a layperson and a staff person strike a deal that says this is an expected behavior. This is a positively sanctioned behavior. These are the things that we want to do. Now, think with me just for a minute about how your churches are actually set up. Churches are set up with big-size meetings They're set up with medium-sized meetings, and they're set up with small-sized meetings. Your church consists of a whole bunch of meetings, okay? And if it has a great big meeting, what you know is there's all kinds of little meetings that went on ahead of time to make the big meeting go. The platform, the singing, the musicians, the lights, the technical, the ushers, the greeters, all the stuff that goes into it. There's just dozens of little meetings that had to happen for the big meeting to occur. And every one of those little meetings is a group of people that can be looked upon as either worker bees or a team that care for one another. Now, the most important shift that you can make in terms of managing your ministry, I believe, is to stop seeing volunteers as individuals and start seeing volunteers as a part of a squad or part of a team. And to understand that if there's somebody in that little group or that little squad or that little committee or that little team, if there's somebody in there that has been deputized to be an agent of pastoral care, the life and health of that little group and that little team is going to be better. They're going to function better. They're going to love one another better. And they're going to have good attitudes about serving. And the management of the morale of that little group isn't that nice? The management of the morale of that little group is under the care of one of your ministry partners, a person who's been deputized to look out for the welfare of the people as well as the folding of the bulletins, the welfare of the people as well as the greeting at the door, the welfare of the people as well as the assembling of the singers, so that there is a notion of morale and care built in to every serving subunit in your church. And that also applies to all the learning subunits and classes and everything else. What you learn is the larger the group, the more little groups had to meet to make that thing pull off. But all those little groups have potential for caring for the people on their teams. I'll never forget what a Presbyterian elder told me one time. A woman of enormous energy and ability. She sat in the elders' meeting after we had briefed her on the concept of caring for her work group. And she had this funny look on her face. One of those not sure whether she liked what she had just eaten looks. And she was in a kind of a puzzled. Her mouth was kind of going in a squiggly line, you know. It wasn't a smile, it wasn't a frown, it was a kind of a sense of dismay and reflection. She says, for 7 years, she says, I have led very effective committees. And until this moment, it never crossed my mind that the spiritual nurture or care of those people should have been a high priority for me. I basically worked these people. And yeah, I've done the thank you notes and things like that, but I basically worked these people, but I didn't see myself as a nurturer of their spiritual lives. And I have missed 7 years of opportunity. That was insightful. Now, every subunit of your church can be a squad of people that are aspiring to be like Jesus and a functioning part of his body, and they can be the worker bees, learners, or whatever else that's involved in addition to that. And once you get that concept clearly in mind, then every time a subunit of your church meets, the body of Christ is assembled. The two and three, and I'm in the midst of them, rule begins to go into effect. But it happens more consistently when somebody is aware of it than when it's just happening in a spontaneous fashion. Now, when I started looking at how do we help people get a big picture grasp of what they're capable of, I started with point five, right in the middle, meet. And I said, okay, whenever a group comes together, it's meeting. Now, that means whether it's coming together for coffee before the parking lot attendant work or whether it's coming together backstage to tune fiddles or whatever. Every time they meet, there's an opportunity for a spiritual interaction. And when I studied the literature as to what was available, what I found was there was a lot of help for how you run a meeting. Almost every curriculum had a little layout in it about how you run a meeting. What was missing was a full understanding of the behaviors that surrounded and prepared and followed that meeting that extended the ministry franchise of the meeting holder to life. Because I became aware of the fact that if your church allows you to conduct a meeting, either as a team leader or as a small group leader, or as a class leader, or as a committee leader, if your church allows you to do that, you are deputized in a way you don't know. You are seen by the people in that group, committee, team, or class. You are seen as an extension of the church's authority. You are seen as a deputy of the pastors of that church. You may not see yourself that way, but because you have the sanctioned power to call a meeting, you have been given the authorities and powers of a deputy. And the mana, or the charisma that goes with that, carries beyond the moment of the meeting all through the week until the next time you hold such a meeting. And you have just made the kingdom business that person's business by virtue of hanging that title on them. They can say, I am a group leader. I am a team leader. I am a committee chair. And when they do, they have the mantle of office. The question is, have you given a rich enough interpretation to the role that allows them to get maximum mileage out of that role for good, other than the very narrow definition of the communion plate passing or whatever else is involved? And that's the privilege you have, to more fully cloak your people with the authority of the role of a minister of Christ. Now, when you reach out from this idea that this is the person who's going to convene the meeting, and you start adding other elements to the role, there has to be some form of reasonableness to this process. And what I did in putting together these nine factors was I had walked through hundreds of interviews with laymen and with staff, and consistently came up with a set of objections, and we, in these nine factors, we met every objection that we had encountered in all those interviews. For example, the first question was, well, where am I going to get the people that I meet with? That was the favorite Sunday school teacher's question. Are you going to send me people? Are you going to give me a room? Am I going to have a curriculum? And if you had been trained by the public school people or by the denominational literature people, you knew those were the appropriate things for them to ask. You're going to meet at such and such an hour in such and such a room. You're going to have the following curriculum to follow, and we'll send you people from ages so-and-so to so-and-so. Just be sure to be there. Okay? Now, that set of expectations eliminated the need for you being responsible for your own attendance, except that what we found was if you didn't touch those people with energy, they didn't want to come back and renew the experience. So all you had to do to treat a person to be a Sunday school class teacher was be excited enough about people that they are so attracted to you that they want to come back into the room with you the next week. That was a fairly simple move. But when you start talking about home meetings or meetings that weren't held in the regular scheduled time, there was a burden as to where we're going to find the attendance for those meetings. And what we've all learned is if a group leader is effective, they do their own inviting. You might furnish them a name once in a while. You might point somebody to them. But the reality is they're going to do their own touching of people between meetings. And so the first thing we did after saying you have the right to have a meeting is to say, and by the way, what you do between meetings and in meetings both have influence whether anybody will be there or not. And you may need to develop a personality in order to get people at your meeting. You may have to pray for those people. You may have to go out of your way. You may have to touch them three or four times. You may have to take donuts. You may have to start treating them like a real person in whom you have a genuine interest. What a concept. And pretty soon they get the idea, so my behaviors toward these people are what assure the invitation being effective and people coming in. Yes, that's right. Oh, okay. Well, I can do that. I mean, yeah, sure, we can do that. And then they realize, I'm responsible for the attendance. And then we say to them, now look, here's what's going to happen in your group. We can predict a couple things. If you're really effective, your group will grow. And it'll grow so big that it'll spoil itself if you don't have a way of offloading some of the people that come to it. So here's what we encourage you to do. Anticipate that you're going to get too big right offhand. and plan for some help that can take some of that load off of you right to begin with. So that's point number two, recruit a helper, an apprentice, and anticipate that they're going to take away some of the people so that the quality of the experience can be protected. Oh, you mean I'm going to have this group, but I'm going to give it away to somebody else, a part of it, yeah. Right up front, you say that. Even if they don't start with one of those, they get one as quick as they can, because you've showed them, how can you protect the quality of experience in your group if it's all successful? Because you know what we have in successful groups? They grow to 12, 15, 18, 20. Pretty soon, you get too many people to enjoy it. And then you're looking for a rainy day or a hailstorm so you can have a small enough group to really have a good meeting again, because there's just too many people coming in. And yet, we're so success-oriented, we don't want to send anybody away, or we close the doors, one of the two. And if we have an apprentice already in place, we can help that happen. We're teaching them not only to help carry the pastoral care load with us, we're teaching them to look ahead to carry the pastoral load for people that aren't even there with us yet. But we can do that by putting in the recruiting protocol. And then, on part four, we make sure that they bring that recruiting person into their preparation and plan the meetings with us so that every time we meet, they have a chance to increase their skills. We never want to have a meeting with one of our apprentices present where they don't do something that increases their practice. The cop who, with skill and determination, gets you through the intersection has had lots of practice to get to that level of skill. You don't want to miss a chance to practice your apprentice while you're still there. Only letting them serve when you're absent is a short-sighted view of training people. And so we have the prepare step that includes the apprentice. We teach people how to be perceived as loyal to the organization. Now, I cannot tell you where you are, but I can tell you that many pastors like you are just jealous enough of their lay people receiving affection and praise from the congregation that they're reluctant to release ministry to them. Most of you have gotten over that hurdle to have churches the size you have, but it's still pretty problematic because, frankly, as ministers, we have some characteristics of being relatively insecure. I confess I don't know how to read the clock that I'm looking at, and I'm a little bit disoriented. Warren, help me. Oh, good. There's no 1-2 on there, so it's...
I'm sorry.
Is that...
It just takes more minutes.
Oh. 14. Okay. Okay, I got it. Okay. It's a wonderful system. Okay. And I'll try to cooperate with it now that I understand it. I kept looking at those numbers saying, I don't know what they're doing down there. Okay. Loyalty. How can you get over your fearfulness of giving power to people? How can you share the mantle with them without the pain of being insecure?